because it's time. It's time for reparations.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Yes, you're listening to The Race Card. Welcome to Sin 90.7 FM, and the time is just over 3. I don't know the specifics, but hey, you know, it's radio. You know, yeah. I'm Ahmed Yusuf, your host for this afternoon's show, and before we begin, we'll be doing an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and pay our respects to their elders both past and present. This land was never ceded, and the process of colonization, occupation, and incarceration that began, and genocide that began over 2 centuries ago, continue to this day. You're listening to our 1 hour show where we chat politics, current affairs, popular culture, with a little bit of a twist, as well as wrapping up the most thought-provoking issues of the week in Australia. Today we have a special interview with Maxine Benham-McClark, talk about the Oromo protests and the significance between about that, talking Black Voices, which was on yesterday, and Trump's ban all Muslims. And we have a featured discussion on Muslim schools. Don't forget to get involved in all the discussions by texting in 027 767 767, or tweet us using the handle at The Race Card. And my co-hosts and guests for this afternoon's show are
Arundhati
and
Maxine Benham-McClark.
And Maxine, it's been really great having you on the show, and we've been talking about getting on for some time, and I guess tell us a little bit of yourself and give our listeners who may not have heard of Maxine Benham-McClark yet, but will very, very soon, about who you are.
I'm a writer. I'm of Afro-Caribbean heritage, Australian born, and I started out primarily as a slam poet, so kind of doing performance poetry around the place. And more recently, I've published a collection of stories called Foreign Soil.
Interesting. I guess you're of Afro-Caribbean descent, and I think also British?
Yeah, well, my parents grew up in London. They were both born in the West Indies, so in Jamaica and Guyana, but they both grew up in London and then migrated to Australia in the mid-70s.
Interesting. And I guess a lot of people think of a lot of black Afro-Black people in the Caribbean are of Caribbean descent, and actually, at Black Voices, we had a colour come on, and he was talking about Brixton, about in the 70s and 80s basically being Jamaica, basically. You were in a different place.
Mm.
And where did your parents live when they were in the UK?
So they have lived in various places, Tottenham, Walthamstow. But I guess, yeah, around that time, the kind of late 60s to late 70s, there was kind of the first generation, I guess, of British-born people from the Caribbean. Migration started kind of around the mid-50s, and so you suddenly had this generation of black kids that essentially were British born but with Caribbean roots. So I think that kind of fostered a really particular culture in certain areas of London.
Interesting. And I guess I know from a mutual friend of ours that you went to the Slavery Museum in Liverpool. Mm-hmm. How was that?
Yeah, I was researching the second. So I've got a memoir coming out later next year called The Hate Race, which is really about growing up black in middle-class Australia, white middle-class Australia. And as a kind of, I guess, sequel to that, I wanted to go back and try and trace my family's roots. So I was awarded something called the Hazel Rowley Fellowship for Biography, which allowed me to go to London at the start of this year in January and do a bit of a research trip. And yeah, one of the places I went to was the International Slavery Museum in Liverpool, which was absolutely haunting, as you can imagine. I mean, I kind of, you know a lot about slavery from reading, from watching documentaries or Hollywoodizations of the slave trade, but to actually go there and see the extent of it and see original kind of items of torture and testimonies from slaves was just horrific, yeah.
Must have been, I guess, very kind of, because obviously being of Afro-Caribbean descent, a lot of the slaves were from that part of the world, and I guess specifically with your parents living there for some time as well, must have brought up some memory, not necessarily memories, but just some scars you didn't know were there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we kind of talk about racism as if it's this contemporary thing, forgetting that it has this, you know, hundreds and hundreds of year history of, you know, black people being suppressed by white people, beaten by white people, raped by white people. And I think we just kind of often don't think of that. We think of racism as someone yelling something on a train. But to actually go, oh, yeah, you know, this actually has a really serious foundation, and the things that were done at that time are really the basis for contemporary racism.
And I guess people don't usually think about racism and kind of like resource extraction, and think about the loss of land, the loss of wealth, the loss of history.
Mm. Absolutely. And I did a lot of kind of talks when I was there, so tours of London and things like that. And one of the tours that I did was you went around and looked at various motifs. And there was things like, you know, the Cutlers Guild of London, who their emblem is like two elephants holding up a shield because they were using ivory from taken from India for the handles of the cutlery. And so there's kind of this massive legacy of just, you know, conquering and raping the entire world to get these resources that he's kind of left in Britain that doesn't really get talked about that often now. You know, it's kind of like, oh, that was the past and this is now. But I mean, that's kind of the foundation of the division of the world, you know, the third world and the first world.
Why do you think there's not necessarily that discussion, particularly in Britain, because we usually associate discussions of race to America. America is the most racist place in the world, and things like that. But we don't usually talk about, if there was no Britain, there'd not be an America. Mm. There'd not be the people, the origins of the people of white Americans stem from Britain, basically.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, I think it's partly that kind of faux politeness of English society that you just don't talk about things that were, you know, in the past. And I think I interviewed some family members of my grandmother's generation, and even some of them were reluctant to actually, when I interviewed them about, you know, how were things when you arrived in England and, you know, what was the racism like, very reluctant to talk about those things, because I think it's that that generational, you know, you don't want to upset the status quo, you don't want to go into talking about these disturbing things, you just get on with life.
Interesting. Aranthi?
Oh, I was just, I just heard that some of your work is being taught in schools. Mm. I was just wondering, how do you feel about the importance of diverse education in terms of writing and in terms of what is being taught in especially Australian schools and British schools?
I think it's really, really important that we have diverse voices on the school curriculum. I mean, when I was at school, it was like Shakespeare, George Orwell, Jane Austen. That was pretty much all there was. I think the closest thing to my experience was like Looking for Ella Brandy, which was about an Italian girl, you know. And so to have my work, there's a few local schools in the kind of West that are studying my work, like Werribee Secondary College is doing it for Year 11. And I think to have stuff that is not necessarily set in white Australia and for kids to see reflections of themselves, it's so important. You know, I didn't encounter literature like that until I was out of high school. And I think had I been exposed to black writers or, you know, non-Anglo-Australian writers at an early age, it would have made my journey so much easier.
Like, I remember, I'm pretty sure everyone's seen Chimamanda's TED Talk about The Single Story. Mm. And if you haven't, check it out. And she basically said she couldn't conceptualize African or specifically to her, where she's from, Nigerian writers. She could not conceptualize a story that included herself or someone who looked like her. Mm. And exactly, reading, writing, visual kind of like movies and TV and everything like that change our perspective, change our, I guess, the way we see the world. How impactful is reading diverse writers, reading black and brown people talking about their stories?
I think it's huge. I mean, particularly when you're young, it validates your life and your experience. And it says, one, that your experience is important enough to go down in writing and go down in history. And also that you have the right to tell your story. I think when I started out in creative writing, I was writing about white people. You know, like I was a student in high school and I just never gave any thought to making a character a brown person, because it was like, there's no Australian stories with, you know, non-Indigenous black people in them. How can I write that kind of thing? So I think just that going, oh, yeah, you know, when I went to Werribee High School, they kind of went, one of your stories is set in Footscray. You know, we all know Footscray. We've been there. We've eaten there. We've, you know, lived there. And it was kind of this realization that, yes, you know, our experience is important and it does, it's a story that does deserve to be told.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you did this very, like, it still resonates with me today. Your poem at the Cornwall West event a few months ago, when you talked about what we know today as AFL and Mangrok. And I guess, talk to us about that and the process of your writing.
So, yeah, it's a poem called Mangrook, and essentially it was inspired by the Adam Goods story, not so much this year, but kind of the first incident that happened where a 13-year-old girl was racially abusing him, and just came from me, I guess, watching that and thinking, this is absurd, because this is an Indigenous game that we're talking about. This is somebody playing an Indigenous game on their own land, which has been stolen from them. And I think that just those basic facts weren't talked about. You know, it was all about kind of, should Adam Goods be tougher? Should we hold this 13-year-old girl responsible? You know, maybe it was her parents' fault. And those kind of fundamental discussion of why this might be wrong or why this might be upsetting wasn't there. And so I wanted to write a spoken word piece that spoke to that and that kind of explored this history of dispossession and, you know, that thing of having to stand on your stolen land, sing a national anthem that doesn't speak to your experience, that's not sung in your language, and then at the end of all of that to have this experience where someone is abusing you. And yeah, I mean, it's a piece that I took quite a long time to write, and I guess I was really mindful of, you know, I'm not an Indigenous person. How do I speak to this experience without kind of co-opting the Indigenous voice or experience?
Interesting. Like, I guess in a more broader sense, with your writing, how do you, what is your process, and I guess how have you found your own voice while writing, with in mind of, as you said, you started writing about white people and you didn't conceptualize a time when you could write about someone who looked just who looked like you and who had similar experiences?
I think that's just come with time and also reading broadly. I think the fact that I was never exposed at high school to people like Toni Morrison or Alice Walker or people who weren't necessarily writing into my experience, or even, you know, Indigenous writers, we didn't read any. I think Sally Morgan was on the curriculum, but we didn't study it. And so just being exposed to other writers and realizing that actually there are thousands of stories out there, and if my story is not out there, then maybe I need to write it. You know, maybe that's something I can do.
I guess, like, on that note, how did you find the process of trying to get published as a black writer, especially within Australia with, I guess, a kind of small group of black writers here?
Very difficult. My poetry, I published with, I was lucky enough to find a really small press, a Picoro Press, which now I think has been acquired by Janindera Press in Adelaide. But Rob Reel there really liked my poetry and was willing to put it out. But it was a very small one-man operation. So it was pretty much he would produce the books and everything else was up to me. So in terms of promoting it, trying to get it into bookstores was quite difficult. And then with Foreign Soil, my short fiction collection, I probably spent about 2.5 years trying to get it published, and it did the rounds, you know, did the rejection rounds of almost every publisher in Australia, I reckon, and then eventually won something called the Premier's Award for an unpublished manuscript, and that was very much a door opener. You know, every single thing that's happened in my career in the last kind of 2 years stemmed from winning this competition. Which I think is great, but also quite sad, because I think there are many versions of me out there who won't win one of these competitions and whose work is probably as good, you know, if not better than mine. And so I guess I hope that as more people of colour get published, you know, doors start to open.
One of the things I'd really like to ask you about is the idea of the black writer and adding that extra element to it, and then this idea that because you are a black writer or a person of colour writing about anything, basically, it has to inadvertently be political, and you have to, in a sense, perform, whether it be blackness, for a crowd. And I guess, how do you navigate that while trying to just write what you want to write?
I guess for a long time I wasn't navigating that. I wanted to talk about blackness because I felt the narrative wasn't out there. And it's only really in the last year that I've started to go, okay, I feel like I've dealt with the things I want to deal with in terms of putting my version of the story out there or representing people like me. How do I now go forward? And I've been lucky enough to have been thrown a few opportunities outside of that. So I do a bit of work for the Saturday paper, writing profiles of, you know, just basically interesting people that I meet along the road, or, you know, people like actors or, you know, chefs, comedians. And so that's been really great for me in terms of going, okay, I don't just have to write about race. It is interesting and fun to do other things. And also that external recognition that, you know, yes, we don't have to just call Maxine when something happens that's race related and we need an opinion piece. And I think that can be a danger that writers of colour get boxed in, not only internally but externally, by editors and by publishers. It's like, no, you have to write that race narrative.
Do you feel that is, in a sense, limiting as well? Because for me as well, like, in my writing, in not into the scale of yours, obviously, but in the sense of feeling that you have to economize yes, economize your trauma, basically, and how that's more a sense acceptable in a very mainstream white audience who, in a sense, by listening or reading your writing, feels, in a sense, more moral and more upstanding.
I think absolutely. I think particularly in memoirs, white readers love the black or the writer of colour trauma narrative, that, you know, I've had a hard life, that I've come from poverty and I've, you know, either risen above or ended up in jail, you know. And, you know, while that is, it's a valid narrative, I think particularly for my memoir, I wanted to write about middle class Australia, because I very much grew up in suburbia, and I think that's a really interesting, you know, we often, when we talk about racism, we talk about rednecks, you know, reclaim Australia, people who potentially don't have a, you know, a high level of education, whereas I wanted to talk about this kind of casual, insidious racism that you get in suburban Australia that is very much not explored. And so I guess I've tried to find ways of doing things differently, in terms of that, you know, the narrative and what my story is, and trying not to play into that kind of narrative that everyone wants you to write, because it sells.
It does. And how do you do that while managing to have a family and two children?
I don't sleep. No, I think, you know, like, that's kind of almost true, you know. I think as a creative person, particularly up until about 4 years ago, I was working a legal job as well. That's kind of my other career. And so balancing that, how much can I of my creative self can I give before it starts to impact on my family time or impact on the other work that I'm doing. I've been lucky enough that in the last year and a half, I've been able to actually make a living off writing and teaching and speaking and things like that, which makes it a bit easier. But, you know, it's just, I guess I look at it as work. You know, it's fun work, but, you know, I look at it as a job.
Oh, yeah. I guess sort of finally, what I found in Australia, that even though the community of writers of colour is really small, the community is really strong. I was just wondering, like, how have you found the support of other writers of colour in Australia to be, especially in getting published and getting jobs?
I think it's been absolutely extraordinary. You know, for me, when I was trying to get Foreign Soil published, you know, I needed to get people to endorse it, you know, so quotes that you put on the cover or whatever. So approaching people like Alice Pung and Randa Abdel-Fattah, Tony Birch, people who are, you know, have been working in that fiction world or non-fiction world as writers of colour for a very long time. And they were just so generous and so ready to give of their time and supportive. And I do think that even though the community is small, there is this sense of solidarity. We all recognise how difficult it is. And when someone new comes along, it's like, yeah, you know, another person's made it through the door. Quick, pull them in, you know. So I think it's great. You know, there's a real sense of camaraderie there.
Yeah, definitely. And I've noticed it myself just by just messaging someone. Like you, for example, I messaged you a few weeks ago and said, can you come on the race card? And you're like, sure, what time? When, yeah. What, you know, and it's that easy. And, yeah. And people listening at home or wherever you're listening, in the car or whatever, you know, you can listen wherever you want. You know, just message someone, send them, shoot them an email, whatever it is. And, you know, you'll be surprised by the response. You really will be. And finally, thank you so much, Maxine, for coming
on the
show.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
What's going on, people? This is Akala, and right now you're listening to The Race Card. Big up.
You're listening to Sin 90.7 FM and we are The Race Card. Yes, now we're going to be going into the week that was. And with me to do this all, obviously, is Rhonda T. Hi there. Still
hey,
here?
I'm yeah. still here, yep.
And we're going to be going to the week that was. The Oromo protests have been gaining momentum on social media, especially after news that the Ethiopian government want to extend the city of Addis Ababa. And, you know, think, why is this a big deal? You know, Ethiopia is one of the more elegant places to go in Africa, the gold standard, if you will, of African development, as the only African nation not to have been colonized by the West. And I guess the issue that I'm thinking is, you know, usually we think of Ethiopia as this great place, and you know, a group of Oromo people in Australia made a video. And we're going to show this to you in a moment. Obviously, we're only going to be showing you the audio, but I still think it's powerful and it sheds light into some of the issues that are facing Ethiopia right now, especially about the Oromo people, the indigenous people of Ethiopia.
The land of coffee beans. The only African country that was never colonized by European powers.
The cradle of humanity. The inspiration for Drake's East African Girl.
Place where they eat the flat sour bread that nobody knows the name of.
One of the fastest growing economies on the African continent.
This narrative of the All Supreme.
Never failing.
Ethiopia rising only really tells one story.
And that story does not represent a majority of Ethiopia's population.
In fact, the majority of Ethiopia's population, the Oromo, are not represented in many parts of Ethiopia's history.
Are not represented now.
And as things stand, won't be represented in the future.
Weeks ago, protests broke out across Ethiopia's Oromia region. Oromia was a land colonised by Abyssinian settlers over 100 years ago with the help of European powers, merging many indigenous lands together and calling it Ethiopia.
So, why are students protesting?
Because the Ethiopian government has reintroduced a plan to expand the capital city, known to the world as Addis Ababa.
But known to the indigenous owners of the land,
the Oromo, as Finfinne.
Over the last 10 years, Oromos have lost 2 million hectares of land.
And this plan to expand the capital city will lead to the displacement of over 2 million more Oromo farmers.
The historical expansion of Addis Ababa
has already seen several Oromo clans disappear.
And this is only going to continue if nothing's done.
And as a result of this very real threat of economic and cultural genocide,
university students,
high school students,
and primary school students have made up a majority of those leading protests across the country.
Oromo athletes,
farmers,
and the residents of the towns are a threat,
have joined this call for justice.
But nobody's listening,
especially the Ethiopian government.
Peaceful protesters are being killed, beaten, and arrested.
Routinely.
Systematically.
And this is an all too familiar story. In May last year, similar demonstrations erupted, again led by peaceful student protesters.
Dozens were killed. Many more were injured.
And hundreds were arrested.
Some are still behind bars.
Without being charged or given the right to a fair trial.
And it's happening again.
But this time,
the call is louder,
clearer,
and more powerful than ever.
Students are chanting messages declaring that if their ancestral land is taken away from them, then they really have nothing left to lose.
So what do we know for sure?
We know if there's anything that's going to make these Ethiopian leaders reconsider its violent dissent against these students,
it's collective, global dissent.
We are well aware that making this video is not going to stop the Ethiopian government from moving forward with these land grabs.
But maybe, just maybe, if they know the world is watching,
they'll think twice before gunning down high school students for exercising their basic human rights.
So get on Twitter using the hashtag #OromoProtests.
And help us put pressure on the BBC,
Reuters, Associated Press, Al Jazeera and CNN to help amplify the voices of East Africa's largest ethnic population
as they call for justice.
I stand with Oromo Protests.
I stand
with the Oromo Protests.
I stand with the Oromo Protests.
I stand with the Oromo Protests.
Do you?
The Oromo Protests have been going on for some time, and on Friday, a group of Australian Oromo people came together in protest of what's going on in Ethiopia right now. And on the line we have Soreti Khadir, who is co-founder of In Our Words, an NGO catering to the African diaspora. And Soreti was one of the organisers of the protest, and we're calling her right now and see if she'll be answering her phone. Fingers are crossed. You know, new calling service. Let's hope it's working. Bring, bring, bring. Bring. But, and here is Soreti. Hi, Soreti. You there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for coming and joining us. And I guess, why isn't this image of Ethiopia ever presented to, I guess, a global audience?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? I didn't hear that.
Why isn't this Ethiopia ever presented to the global audience about what's happening to Oromo farmers, what's happening to Oromo people in general in Ethiopia?
Well, I think it's because Ethiopia's narrative as it stands now, as it's received now by most of the West, is the narrative that depicts the picture of the entire continent to be one of development and to be one of, I guess, progression with the assistance of Western money. And it's an example that, you know, America and Britain often use as, you know, this pinnacle of success, this pinnacle of development, specifically development, you know, especially in relation to the Millennium Development Goals that passed. And so painting a different picture of Ethiopia would contradict this entire idea and would be completely useless to powers like Britain and powers like the US. And so, and because they control these media outlets that we want to be reporting about Oromo farmers and about Oromo students, and, you know, it doesn't serve them, and it serves justice, and it serves, you know, equal representation, and we know that's not what mass media is there to serve.
I guess for listeners unaware of the situation, could you give us a brief history of the Oromo people and their standing in Ethiopia?
Yeah, definitely. So Oromo people are the largest ethnic population, indigenous population to the Horn of Africa. In Ethiopia alone, they make up about 40 million people. And this is about 70 to 80% of Ethiopia's population. And before this idea of Ethiopia was ever created, just like all countries in Africa are fabrications of European, I guess, ideas of lines and borders, Ethiopia was just scattered indigenous lands that belonged to many different indigenous clans and in many different indigenous groups. And these were pulled together, majority of which was Oromo land, and then it was called Ethiopia. And so for hundreds of years, Oromos have lived under Abyssinian rule. And the story has changed, you know, from empire to empire. And they now have been living under the rule of a government that calls itself democratic, but it is not very democratic as we see now. It's been in power for 25 years and is made up of minority ethnic group, the Tigray people. And this is the people group that make up most of the ruling party at the moment. And as it stands in Ethiopia, one of the biggest crimes that you can commit is to not identify with the ruling party. But in order to identify with the ruling party, you need to identify with the ruling ideology, which is inherently Abyssinian supremacist. And so just being an Oromo, not even having political views that, you know, are about independence or self-determination, or even just being an Oromo is contradictory to the ideology of the ruling party. And so this is the reality that Oromos have lived under for a long time. I mean, it wasn't even until 1901 that Oromo could speak Oromo without going to jail or being killed. And so the Oromo identity, the Oromo existence is something that Abyssinian rule has tried to erase from the societal fabric of Ethiopia for hundreds of years.
Given that history and what you've said that's been going on for hundreds of years, what is different now? What's leading this new movement that's leading young people in the diaspora to protest so heavily?
Well, I mean, let's begin with understanding that these protests didn't begin in the diaspora. The diaspora protests are solely in solidarity with protests that are being led in the country at the moment by Oromo students. The reason these protests are being led, and this isn't the first time we've seen them as well, the first time they broke out was last year in May. The reason they broke out is because the government introduced a plan known to them as the Addis Ababa Integration Plan, which is to expand Addis Ababa by 20 million more hectares of land. And this means displacing 20 million farmers that reside in towns around Addis Ababa, and also erasing the identities of these towns, which are a lot of them are distinctly Oromo. And so this is threat to livelihood, this is threat to identity, this is threat to culture, and it's investment in assimilation and investment in land grabs. And so after last year's protests, they broke out. We did the same thing, solidarity protests across the country, and then the government kind of backtracked a little bit. But this year they've reintroduced that plan, and the same reaction by students, but this time a lot heavier and a lot more sustained. We've seen that the protests have broken out now over a month ago, so they're still going, and they're only getting larger and larger and larger in number. And that means that more and more people are being killed, more and more people are being brutalized, more and more people are being arrested. So really, the reason why people are protesting in Ethiopia at the moment is because their land is at threat, their identity is at threat, and their future is at threat, essentially. Land is livelihood to a people that have had everything else stripped away from them, and it's not livelihood in just the economic sense. It's livelihood in the ancestral senses, and this land is often passed down, you know, through long lineage, and is the only connection that a lot of Oromos actually still have to the indigenous land, you know, which is what a lot of, you know, cultural practice is based on, and cultural ideology is based on. So land is important, and it's being grabbed from Oromos, and that's the issue right now.
Also, to come back to what's going on right now and what you're doing on the ground in Australia, you are also a co-founder of In Our Own Words, and they hosted an event called Black Voices, which I was also a part of. How was the day? And tell listeners what Black Voices was about.
Yeah, so Black Voices was the first convention or first large-scale event that In Our Own Words has had. It's been around for a year now. And the basic premise of it, the underlying premise of the event, was to connect, mobilize, and empower the Black African diaspora. And so it was an amazing day. I'm only really just getting the chance to process and reflect on it now. It's just kind of happened for me, and it was a year in the works. It was a lot of work, and not in the sense of it was hard work, but in the sense of it was work that you just don't do with that little resource. It's often deemed impossible. And so the fact that it happened in itself was such a huge success. We had Akala from the UK, we had Solomon Lema from the US, we had Shola Amus from the UK, and who brought so much insight and so much expertise and so much experience to the conversations that were being had. And then we also had incredible local speakers like Gary Foley. We had Samira Farha. We had indigenous rapper Jimbla, and it was hosted by a fashion curator, art curator, Natasha Janelle. So, I mean, it was an incredible day of connection, and what I was really impressed by was the fact that it was 7 hours long, and we had an entire room, over, I would say over 200 people, but I don't actually know exactly how many people were there, engaged that entire 7 hours in just conversation and panel discussions. So it was brilliant. I really, yeah, I think it was a huge success.
I was there, and I can test. I just echo everything you said. It was an amazing day, and I'm also just getting over it as well. And yeah, hopefully things like this just continue to happen in Australia. Thanks, Soreti, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. That was Soreti Khadir from In Our Own Words talking to us about Black Voices as well as the Oromo protests. And you can get more information about the Oromo protests by searching hashtag Oromo protests on Twitter or Facebook and all social media. And now going somewhere new, not really new, the States. We're going to talk about, Donald. Well, Mr. Trump has put his foot in his mouth again, but when isn't he? You know, recently he's called for a ban. And well, I'm pretty sure people can imagine who he's referring to in this ban he's talking about. Here's a clip from a speech he made for his loyal listeners and audience in the States a few days ago.
So listen, Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. No choice. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Yes, you know, he has no choice but to ban all Muslims, doesn't he, Arundhati?
Totally, no choice at all. Definitely not.
Like, Muslims just need to be out of there. Like, it's pretty obvious. Like, you know, when I heard, I was like, Trump. I don't even want to go to the U.S., you know. I don't want to go to a cultural imperialist land that is a settler colonialist land that, commits genocide to the indigenous people of the land, the Native Americans. And you know, I don't think that's a very nice place to go. That's just me. But, you know, there's been some backlash around it here.
Yeah.
Did you find something fishy about that? Like, about Trump? You know, this week, The Daily Show's Hassan Minhaj put a few pieces together about Trump, and, you know, it revealed something very interesting.
Second theory, and I think this is where the evidence points. Donald Trump is an extremist leader who came out of nowhere. He's self-financed, recruits through social media, attracts his followers with a radical ideology to take over the world, and is actively trying to promote a war between Islam and the West.
Oh my God, Hassan, he's white ISIS.
That's right, Trevor. Donald Trump is white ISIS. Wysis.
That's kind of catchy, Wysis. I like that. The big question is, though, what can we do to combat Wysis?
It's very simple. Can I be real? Can I be real, Trevor? I mean, I just...
Be real.
Yeah, I just want to be real.
Just be you, man. Be real.
Where are all the moderate white conservatives? I mean, come on. They got a responsibility to step up and speak out against WISIS, because I'm sick of this.
Yeah, but Hassan, in fairness, conservatives have already spoken out against Trump. Here it is.
Jeb Bush called it unhinged. Chris Christie, ridiculous. John Kasich, divisive. Marco Rubio, offensive.
We're now going to violate the constitutional rights of citizens because of Donald Trump? I don't think so.
I do not comment on what's going on in the presidential election. I will take an exception today. This is not conservatism, not what this party stands for. And more importantly, it's not what this country stands for.
You see, Hassan, conservatives don't stand behind ISIS.
I don't know, Trevor. I just don't buy it. I still don't feel safe. So, look, I know there's just a lot of nuance to the situation and every conservative isn't the same, I know. But it's just easier on my brain to be irrationally afraid of an entire group of people. So, until we can figure out what's going on here, I, Hassan J. Minhaj, say we should not allow any conservatives into the White House.
You know, I think he's got something there, you know? I'm just saying, you know, like, I don't know. I don't feel safe around, you know, conservatives, you know? Just, you know, they're just saying a lot of, like, Tony Abbott, right? You know, Donald Trump, you know, like, all conservatives are the same.
Totally.
You know, like, Donald Trump's white ISIS, he's WISIS, and, you know, like, I don't know. Even though, you know, there might be people condemning his actions, I'm just saying, you know, are they doing enough?
Yeah, are they all the same underneath their...
You know, is this just a veiled attempt to, you know, to get at Muslims? You know what
totally.
I mean? Like, I don't feel safe. That's why I'm not going to America. I just genuinely do not feel safe.
Fair enough, yeah. After this.
You know,
it's just ridiculous.
It is, you know. But anyway... Moving swiftly on, a few months ago, there was an article written about Muslim schools and the mistreatment of young Muslim girls. Amongst the speculation, Lamis Hamoud wrote an interesting article about her experiences at Al Taqwa College. And, you know, I also went to Islamic school and I have a lot of stories about that. But also... when we talk about Islamic schools, it's difficult to navigate what discussion we're going to have. But to help us do that is Lamis. Hello, Lamis. Are you there?
Yeah, Lamis, yeah.
Hi, Lamis. Thanks for coming on the show. And I guess, you know, when we talk about Muslim schools, it's difficult to kind of talk about them in a frank and critique them whilst being wary of the latent Islamophobia that's presently out there.
Yeah, that's true. It is very difficult. It's a difficult space to navigate. But that's just generally in all types of critique of our community.
Definitely. Because I know I've got some stories about when I was at my school. I'm not going to name names, but
yeah.
I remember when we were at school, the women and young girls, say for example, if they were tucking in their scarf, they were told not to tuck in their scarf because, you know, they're attracting boys. You know, they're making their breasts look bigger, and that's what some of the things that some teachers said. And I guess these small little things obviously happen. But how do you find? Because I know when you wrote that piece, a lot of people came at you. A lot of people criticized you, and a lot of people in the community maybe ostracized you. How do you find talking about these issues without trying to be with your community but also critique it in a sense?
Yeah, wow. I guess it's also about being sensitive to your community and like also being careful about what spaces you choose to access in order to air grievances or to make critiques. And I guess one of the most difficult things is the fact that it is hard to find places internally within the community where you can express concerns. And I guess what I find was one of the biggest issues with the article was the fact that, you know, taking it to a mainstream media organization that does not necessarily have the best intentions or agendas. And, you know, having, you know, my voice filtered through that sort of media arm. And I look back on it now and it's a lot of it also seems, you know, quite unintentionally imperialist, as though like, you know, coming down and telling a community how to behave and conforming to some sort of like Western norms when, you know, that wasn't my intent, but I can see how it comes across that way, particularly when you access particular media outlets. And it's just about then finding ways, how do we in our community address our own issues? Because we understand the culture and the issues behind it. We understand where these behaviors are coming from, why these girls are being told not to tuck in their hijabs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. While to an outsider, you know, they can manipulate that sort of information because they don't understand where these sort of issues actually stem from.
I agree, and it's the kind of thing where people divorce things from context, and the kind of thing where, you know, there is lots of misogyny among Muslim people, as well as there a lot of misogyny among Christians and among a lot of people. And I guess the way it works is differently in different contexts because it's coded differently.
Continue.
Like I was saying, and like for me, for example, like I know there was instances where I associated Islam and tried to make it into this like it's just with any religion, there's a sense of conservatism amongst it when we can take a number of different viewpoints with that. About trying to have a discussion without being put down, and also without, as you said, having media arms filtering the message.
Yeah, totally. And also to always remember that, you know, that's also your own subjective experience, and that none of us really ever come from any type of objective critique, you know. It's all grounded in our own context and our own understandings and our own experiences. And, you know, I've spoken to other students who've been like, but, you know, your experiences didn't reflect my experiences. I never felt that at the school. So what gave you the right to then talk about the school that way? And I was like, you know what? I'm really glad you said that, because actually you're right, you know, and that made me realize how sometimes we have to be really careful when we do critique to not then silence others and to not then present our own voice as the like overarching or the only voice, and to remember to remain subjective. And I mean, like, you know, you learn. Like for me, I've learned a lot from obviously the experience. And I do like feel bad for the repercussions that it had. But at the same time, you know, basically that's it.
Yeah, and I guess sometimes the way to get things started is by talking about it as loudly as you can. And obviously we're not static in our opinions and our views. There's always room for change. And as you said, like, initially when I read your piece, I was thinking, is that the best avenue? And all those things. And are you being manipulated? And is your arguments being filtered down? Because obviously the editorial process and what have you with big media companies and stuff and those issues that come with that. How do you feel now since a few months have passed since you wrote that piece, and I guess your impressions with people you've spoken to since?
I guess like the biggest thing I've taken from it all is that I really want to stop directing energy outwards. And I mean, and if that's what Islamophobia, I find that's what it does, is that it keeps forcing you to direct your energy outwards, and not just that, but at the same time it also silences you. So on the one hand, when you critique, you then are scared to critique because you're worried that it's going to fall into that sort of a narrative. So then you're silent. But then when you do speak out, it falls into that narrative, and then your voice is like, it's wasted, right? So I think the most important thing is then to turn inwards into our communities and to just work on ourselves and to work on our own communities and to work within our own spaces, and to try and stop wasting so much energy fighting against or like speaking out or talking against all these forces, because our energy can be used towards building ourselves and building our own strength instead of trying to change these outside issues and these outside forces that are just really, I don't know if they're ever going to go away.
Thanks, Amice. It's been really great speaking to you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no worries, Ahmed. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That was Lamis talking about Muslim schools and I guess the issues with talking about your community outwardly. And I know if I spoke about outwardly of my experiences at Muslim schools, they would be taken without context, without the context of there being many different ethnic groups that are Muslim. There are many different schools of thought. There are conservative Muslims, there's fundamentalist Muslims, there's more very socially quote-unquote progressive Muslims, or whatever that may be, and divorcing it of any context.
Totally. I mean, the same thing happens. I mean, a similar thing happens, I guess, within the Indian community for me when we talk about arranged marriages. And you can't talk about those things like Lamis said about talking about things outwardly. It's not possible because, yeah, the message will get hijacked and it's very hard to be honest.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
But even with arranged marriage, like literally arranged marriage is basically your mum or your any parent whatsoever saying, hey, kid. There's this person I know that's interested in seeing someone. Here's the number. Here's their details.
Exactly.
You do the rest.
It's not necessarily negative. No, I mean,
it's not negative. But this is the thing. Like, I guess it's like with anything, it's with arranged marriage. It's about creating the agency of mobility and being able to kind of like do what you want with whatever it is. Like, arranged marriage is basically online dating.
Totally.
Just with your parents involved or a family member, and they're just saying, hey, you know, there's this person right here. Like, my mom said to me, if my mom wanted to arrange a marriage with me, she would just say, hey, Ahmed, here's this woman, you know, you're getting around that age of marriage. You know, if you're interested, here's their number. Give them a call. Set up a meeting and, you know, see how you go. It's basically just like, that's it. There's other kind of like, there's a very westernized idea of
I guess
that as
the,
well.
Western narrative is of forced marriage, which is clearly obviously negative, but that's not the manifestation in all senses. That said, also, I mean, arranged marriage is also, you know, I mean, I think the thing from this discussion is that I guess patriarchy is global. It's going to manifest in almost every single culture and every religion in different ways. It's going to be coded in different ways and it's going to be translated in different ways. And we have to find ways to talk about those things in our communities without other communities, specifically the West, hijacking them and, you know, I guess scapegoating their misogyny onto other cultures.
Boom. And I think that's a great way to end the show. Thanks for you listening at home or in the car or on the train. Or walking home, or wherever you might be, you can, if you want to, you know, go back and listen to our other shows, you can, by searching us on iTunes, which you can find us at, by searching the race card. You can find us on. This is me shuffling some papers. you can find us also on Mixcloud by searching race card. Twitter by using the handle @TheRaceCard. Yeah, The Race Card. I'm not very good at this, am I? No. And Facebook.com/RaceCardShow. You can find me on Twitter @AhmedYusuf10. I'm pretty sure they can find you also.
You can find me @RamLakshmi.
And yeah, that's our show for this week. Hope you've enjoyed it and goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi.
Bye.